Welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. A new Epic MRA poll looks at 600 responses to the question, what should the state spend its billion-dollar surplus on? This appears in today's Detroit Free Press. Top of the heap, 600 responses. Top of the heap, 38% say education. A close second at 36%, roads. And the winner of a bronze medal at 11%, an income tax cut. As you likely know, much energy and discussion at the Capitol right now, the Republican majority Capitol, is being spent on the idea of the tax cut. Governor Snyder wants an expansion of a property tax credit, which he says would target low and moderate income citizens. Many Republicans maintain an income tax cut, and I'll quote reporter Kathleen Gray here, is the most efficient, simple, and fair way to give tax relief to the state's taxpayers. Every government budget is interesting. This year will be no exception. Speaking of dollars, speaking of public revenue, the Ingham County Board of Commissioners is looking at a possible increase in the county parks millage. Earlier this week, the body asked its County Services Committee to begin work on a draft proposal. The focus of a millage increase would primarily be an expansion of Lansing's River Trail network. Commissioners receptive to the idea view it as a way to attract visitors and revenue. Skeptics say Ingham's millage tab, which is currently just over 10 mills, is already among the highest in the state. They say the county has more pressing needs. We welcome two Ingham County commissioners to Current State, both of whom voted for a draft proposal. They are Democrat Diane Holman, chairperson of the committee that will write the draft. Hi, Diane.
Hello.
And a member of that committee, Democrat Carol Koenig, who reps much of East Lansing and parts of Meridian Township and MSU. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Mark. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. I noticed a shake of the head during the intro. Let's clarify, if I had anything wrong in my setup, let's clarify that from the outset.
First off, Mark, there is no countywide parks millage in Ingham County.
Okay, so to say there's an increase in the millage, okay, this would be the first parks millage assessment.
Correct.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
We currently off, the parks, our department is totally operated off a general fund, and the fees that they receive from
parking,
entrance fees, or even concessions from fishing or boating.
Okay.
So there's no additional millage. Oh, a special millage for that.
Okay.
There's no park millage in the county.
Appreciate the clarification.
One other clarification.
Okay.
This doesn't have anything at this point earmarked or specially designated for the River Trail. Not to say that the River Trail wouldn't be included in some ways, but it's really not specifically to that. That's not why we're doing this.
So quite a bit of the reporting, though, links those two together.
It does.
Why is that?
Because the River Trail is a great resource for a lot of different people in Ingham County, not just the people of Lansing. And some people see that it needs some tender, loving care. They might need some capital improvements.
Okay. So
I think originally, maybe 2 years ago, there was talk from the mayor's office about linking something with the River Trail and the county parks department, but we're very independent and we're looking at this very objectively, and it would be really a county operation.
Well, both of you voted in favor of pursuing a draft.
Right.
I'd like to hear from both of you why. Why is the draft of a county parks millage a good idea, Carol?
There's a few reasons, actually. It was a unanimous decision to go forward. We did not do a roll call vote on it because we're not actually voting on anything that we were going to specifically pass yet. We're just about continuing the conversation, about moving forward with it. It came to us from the Parks Department, who has actually researched this for the last 3 or 4 months. So they've done a lot of work on it and have asked the county to consider it. We'd like to have a community conversation about what a millage could do for the trails and parks in Ingham County.
Okay. And Diane?
Yeah, so that will be coming to the County Services Committee of the County Board of Commissioners, which I'm chair of that committee. And I guess my objective in all of this is to really look at it from a broad perspective. The Parks Park Commission, you know, they're advocates of the parks. They're very park-oriented. And, of course, they're going to, you know, really like this idea. So and we just want to bring it into a broader perspective at county service, look how it fits into the whole full county setting and programs, and just see if this is something that we should move forward with.
And if I could comment, the Parks Commission is so interested in this because we've had since 2009, Parks has lost almost 40% of its budget mm-hmm. because of hard economic times. Mm-hmm. So they've had to make up, I think it was approximately 38.7%. So it was a big cut.
We will be talking with someone who has gone on the record as being against the idea of a county parks millage, however, in just a few minutes. So I realize opposition to this may not have been really explicit the other night when you decided to move this to committee, but there are people on the record as being against it. We'll deal with that in just a minute. Are we likely talking about a half mil or thereabouts?
Correct.
Okay.
But it's not set in stone.
Right. It's the beginning of a, mm-hmm. a exploratory kind of process.
Right. It could go a lot of different directions at this point.
How likely is it that a lot of it would be earmarked to the river trail, though? Have you given that any thought?
None of it would be earmarked at this point for anything. Right now, I've asked our parks director to put together a list of priorities so that we could talk about the top 5 or 10. But that doesn't mean that those things would absolutely get the money. It's just things that are, shall we say, more desperately in need.
Among those of you who support drafting the proposal, is it clear at all how many of you vigorously support the idea as opposed to just being open to the idea?
I would say that question came up at a recent leadership meeting, and it was very unclear.
Okay. Which camp do you fall in?
I fall in the middle. I feel that I want to see what this next phase brings of investigating and thinking of different options. And, you know, I just have to see what it looks like before I think it's something that we should be pursuing right now.
Carol, have you gotten any response from your constituents?
Actually, I have gotten a little bit of response, but you got to understand, Mark, this really isn't out there in the public eye yet that much. And we've got lots of time to consider it, and we're looking for public input at this point because as we move forward, we want to hear what people think after we start to put more ideas out there. Some of the interest has come from people who are really interested in regionalism because this would allow us to do possibly matching grant funds for other jurisdictions who don't have the money anymore to match funds so that we could have $3 to $1 coming into Ingham County. Basically, there's DNR grants out there that are not being used right now because people don't have the 25% matching funds to put towards a project. We might be able to help them with that.
Okay. I did speak with Republican Commissioner Randy Schaefer about this, and he told me that other county departments are more in need of revenue than parks. Let's listen to his comment.
All of our departments have taken some cuts. As you know, the Sheriff's Department was completely slashed. He lost 37 people in 3 years. And the Parks Department has adjusted with some fees, some less maintenance, and so forth. And so they're not really hurting.
Can a case be made that there would be better places to spend additional millage revenue than on parks and trails, like public safety?
Well, you have 14 commissioners all with, you know, different priorities and areas that they support strongly, and it's a real variety. So, I mean, there are always many areas. I think even another way we'll see this becoming more important in the county is I think the health department is going more and more toward preventative programs and healthy communities. So I could really see us working maybe even in our soon coming study of this is working with the health department and how trail system throughout the county. It's not just about bikers and recreation, but it's about how it also fits into the whole healthy community.
A health piece. Okay.
Yeah.
Carol, care to respond to Randy's comments?
Yeah, and it's a placemaking piece in a big way. We have a lot of little pieces of trail that would connect throughout the county and actually sort of tie the whole county together. There's two different maps out there. One is called the Heart of Michigan map, and the other, I think, was the Greening of Mid-Michigan map. Mm-hmm. And these have trails that basically just need a little section sometimes put together so that people could, you know, come here as a destination for riding bikes and everything else. As to Randy's comment, I would say that for him to say that the Parks Department is not hurting is completely untrue. Like I said, they lost almost 40% of their budget. So definitely the Parks Department is hurting, but
I think his point would be that you could make a case that many departments are hurting, but that the public safety is arguably should be a higher concern, and they've taken a lot of hits too. That's what I took away from that comment.
And in my 12 years on the county board, I tend to be guided by what is my priorities are safety related and health related. So I'm sensitive to the law enforcement comments that Randy made, but also I see this fitting into the health side of it all. So that's why I haven't ruled this out. I still think it could be a good piece for the county, and just want to see what our task force will bring.
He also says the millages that are levied in Ingham County right now are already amongst the highest in the state. They are above 10 mills, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What do you make of that count, that there's already enough millage revenue coming into the county?
Yeah. Well, 6.3% of that is a general fund millage. So when you got to specify, are you talking about in general fund dollars, or are you talking about special millages? So basically, the vast majority of that is our general fund.
So the city of Lansing would benefit from the county picking up more of the tab for parks, though, correct? I mean, this conversation goes back a few years.
When we say picking up the tab, let's be clear that we're not really talking about maintaining other people's parks and trails. We're really talking about helping them with capital improvements.
Okay. What's the timeline on this? When do you think the committee will have a draft ready to go? Do you have some kind of deadline here?
I guess I was thinking to get started, maybe what we'd work into setting a schedule for the progress of it is there a compelling reason that we want to get it in this cycle, or is it something we'll think a little longer term about working on? But really, it's all could be anything at this point. So whether it would go on this November already, or maybe be a longer project that we're working on, we still have that yet to decide.
Let's talk about the search for the two new county directors. You're looking for a new director for the health department and for animal control. Can you tell us where each of those processes stand right now?
Sure. I can tell you that we've done interviews for our health director, and we haven't come up with a decision at this time. And that one is moving forward pretty rapidly, but the animal control one is not in the same place yet. We haven't even actually put out a description.
Okay. And did you have a lot of are you getting a lot of responses, a lot of applications, interested parties in both of those?
We had about 19 or 20 applications for the health director position, but we had to screen a lot of it for a lot of requirements. This is somebody who wears many hats and has a lot of different duties that are very, very important.
Okay, very good. We want to thank both of you for joining us here today to talk about the possibility of a county parks millage in Ingham County. We've been talking with Diane Holman, chairperson of the committee that will write this draft, along with Democrat Carol Koenig, who reps much of East Lansing and parts of Meridian Township and MSU. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. Big data is being applied across a broad spectrum of disciplines. Businesses are using it to forecast consumer trends, political junkies to predict elections before they happen, and scientists are decoding DNA in minutes, working to find cures and prevent disease. Big data can also tell us a lot about the environment, so much that it's shifting the discipline of ecology, creating a new field called macro systems ecology. And Michigan State University Professor Patricia Serrano is a pioneer of macro systems ecology. She joins us now to tell us more. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Before we get into this new field of ecology, talk to us about the more traditional approach to ecology.
Sure. So ecologists are a bunch who like to be outdoors, generally. And that suits us well because one of the best ways to study natural systems is to be outside collecting samples, sometimes doing experiments outside, and sometimes bringing samples back to the lab and processing them in the laboratory.
Okay. And what's changed?
Well, we can't just study one ecosystem or one system. Often we go out and sample one lake or one stand of forest. But now we have to understand how thousands of lakes work, how thousands of lakes and forests might respond to climate change, or how they might respond to changes in pathogens that are coming in invasive species. And to understand that, you have to look at more than one system. And you have to sort of scale back and look at a whole region and sometimes a whole continent. And every once in a while, you have to look at how other continents or the globe is influencing the region that you're looking at.
So globalization has taken place in more than just the economy.
Yes, exactly.
It's really changed a lot of other things as well.
Definitely.
Could you give us an example of the kinds of research questions that might be asked in the macro system ecology field?
Yeah, so I mentioned already the effect of climate change.
Yeah.
So ecologists have been studying potential effects of climate change for years now. But we also know that, for example, to predict ranges of species change, particularly invasive species, we need to be studying the borders of those ranges. We also need to study in the middle of the ranges where organisms are. So we're talking about potentially studying the entire continent of North America if we want to look at, for example, how mosquitoes and mosquito species are going to change with climate change. And mosquitoes are a really important vector of some diseases that obviously affect humans. And so we need to step back and look at much broader scales. So climate change, land use change, invasive species, these are examples of problems where just looking at one system, we can't get the full picture.
This seems to be such a product of computerization in the digital world. You're able to acquire mountains more data than you used to.
Right.
But you've also got the tools in so-called supercomputers to really crunch an awful lot more
right.
data. So you got more data coming in and you're able to do more things with it. Is that a way to look at this?
Right, right. It's an intersection of a lot of really exciting changes in science right now. So one, we have a lot more data out there. You can think about satellite images. There's more sensors that are being developed to go out and measure the natural world. A great example are camera traps, where we can set out really cheap cameras and monitor mammal populations, typically. We haven't been able to do that in the past because cameras have been expensive and we didn't have the technology. So we've got a lot more data. We have faster computers. And we also have this rich knowledge of the natural world that ecologists have built up from the last 100 years, right? You can't just have data and tools. You also need the theory and the concepts and the knowledge of the natural system to apply all these great data sets and tools to these problems.
Patricia, would you say that any effective measure to address, say, climate change is likely going to come about as a result of macro systems ecology?
Well, I would say we need to take a multi-pronged approach, right? Macro systems ecology would never replace the traditional mode of ecology. We need both. We need to understand the fine scale mechanisms, what's going on at the small scale, but then we need to be able to scale that up to the big scale. And we need to incorporate both into our knowledge. So far, we've focused much more on the fine scale. And what other macro systems ecologists and myself are saying is that, okay, let's take that knowledge, apply it to the broad scale. And actually, I think the real answer is going to come when we integrate the broad scale and the fine scale.
Where does all of this potentially useful data come from?
Oh, that's a great question. So a lot of different sources. So satellite imagery is one, and there's been satellites circling the globe for decades now, but we're getting newer sensors. We have faster computers to process that satellite imagery. But satellites don't measure everything. Another great, exciting source is citizen data. So citizens out there collecting data, inputting it in their iPhones, and sending it to researchers, that's a really new and exciting area of merging sort of citizen and public participation and technology. Another great source is ecologists are starting to band together those who study individual sites in different parts of the globe and saying, you know what, let's put all our data together, let's try to use common methods, and then we can analyze our data all together. And so these are emerging networks, and sometimes these networks are grassroots, so ecologists just getting together, and sometimes the government is organizing these government agencies. So it's a really exciting time for lots of different areas of data are coming together.
Our guest is Patricia Serrano. She's a professor in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife here at Michigan State University. We're talking about macro systems ecology, an emerging field. How does macro systems ecology redefine the culture of what you do? How does it manifest itself in a university setting?
That's a great question, because ecologists, you know, as scientists, we have a culture that we're used to working with. Ecologists are used to working with other people, but not that many other people. For example, when I was trained, I worked with about five other people, and that was viewed as a fairly collaborative project. Now I have a team of about 20 people that are very interdisciplinary. So I have geographers, computer scientists, statisticians, database administrators.
Will this increase interdisciplinary collaboration?
I think so, yes. And I think a lot of science is going in this direction, recognizing that problems are getting more complex, so we need multiple disciplines working together.
Just navigating this landscape sounds headache-inducing. it sounds like a huge challenge.
It is. So managing large teams is challenging, and I'm lucky to have one of the leading ecologists, I think, in the country who is figuring out ways to make teams work better. And she is helping our team function wonderfully.
I have to ask, do you think that this emphasis on macro systems, will this bring a different kind of student into the field of ecology?
I'm actually hoping that it does, because I think ecology needs to broaden its base of people who become interested in the field. And so this focus on integrating technology, more computing, maybe a little broader scale, looking at potential links to human health, that can bring a more diverse student body into the field to tackle some really challenging problems that are facing the globe. And I think for ecology to be viable and to solve these problems, we need to diversify our student body.
You've been acknowledged as a pioneer of macro systems ecology. Who are you collaborating with, and where are these people? Are they primarily in this country? Are they in Europe? Where are they?
Well, there's a lot of people doing this kind of research. The team that I'm leading right now are primarily in the United States, Wisconsin, Iowa, Penn State, so pretty broad across the United States. But really, people are doing this across the globe.
This will only continue to change, won't it?
I hope so.
Continually accelerate the threshold of the data that you're able to gather and process?
I hope so. I hope this is just the beginning, and it's a really exciting time to be an ecologist. I can just think about how ecology is going to look 30 years from now, and I hope it's a very different landscape.
It's not an official program, from what I'm told, but you see it growing into a more established program in the future.
I hope so, because I think that will really help crystallize attracting students, particularly in computing and informatics, database management. Those are the kind of skills we really need to move this research forward. And we need those people to be active players on the teams. They can't just be support staff. They've got to be sitting at the table and driving the research. So I think formal programs will help us get there.
Is there a particular ecological challenge that you spend most of your time looking at or involved with?
Well, right now my team is studying water quality and the response that water quality will likely have to climate change and land use change, say in the next 30 years. So we've compiled data on 55,000 lakes across the country and are trying to study the diversity of water quality that we have now and make the links to land use and climate to forecast how that might change in the future.
So we're talking smaller inland lakes, or do you ever look at the Great Lakes?
Actually, mostly inland lakes, but we do include the Great Lakes in our data. And so we might include sort of them as a very unusual case, but they would be an interesting comparison to the inland lakes.
Okay,
yes.
Very good. Well, we want to thank you for your participation here today. Very interesting discussion. Patricia Serrano is a professor in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife here at Michigan State University. She's considered a leader in the field of macro systems ecology. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. Housing discrimination is often difficult to even notice, much less prove. Landlords who don't want to rent to someone based on their race, age, religion, disability, or sexual orientation many times have what seem like legitimate excuses that are often delivered with what our next guest calls a smile and a handshake. Pam Kish is the executive director of the Ann Arbor-based Fair Housing Center of Southeast Michigan, which investigates complaints of illegal housing discrimination in six counties, including Ingham. Last fall, the Fair Housing Center was awarded a $275,000 grant by the Department of Housing and Urban Development to reduce housing discrimination. And joining her is Loretta Codrington, an Ann Arbor resident whose experience in the early 90s still highlights how housing discrimination based on race can occur. I began the conversation by asking Pam to clarify just what the law says.
The Federal Fair Housing Act bans discrimination based on race, color, religion, national origin, sex, disability, and familial status, which is a fancy word for families with kids under the age of 18. And then state law adds marital status and age to that list.
Now, what are some of the ways someone actually is discriminated against then? What happens?
Sometimes someone will be told to their face, I'm sorry, we don't rent to kids. We're not set up for kids. We rent to students. They might say, you can't live here if you have a disability. We're not set up. We don't have a ramp. You can't put a ramp in here. It's not going to look good. When it comes to race discrimination, it's much more subtle. We talk about discrimination with a smile and a handshake. Mm. People in the housing industry know that they are not allowed to discriminate on the basis of race. And so if that's their plan, they need to do it subtly. And it will sound more like, I'm so sorry, I just rented the last apartment, I lost your application, your credit's not quite good enough. When we know that they were, when we investigate, we find out that the person's credit would have been fine given the standards of that apartment complex.
Loretta, talk to us about what happened in your situation.
Well, we were discriminated against based on race. I mean, directly based on race. And we were really surprised about this because, you know, to us, this was something that happened to our parents or our grandparents, not something that happened in this day and age.
How long ago did this happen?
We actually ended up moving to Ann Arbor. We tried moving to Ann Arbor in 1990, and about 91 or 92 is when we found out that, you know, this situation was happening. Yeah, I mean, in the 90s, you know, people saying you can't, we don't want to rent to you because you're black, and, you know, we're educated, you know, we're not, I mean, it would have been an asset for them to have us there.
What did they say, though, exactly? Did they say they don't want you because you're black?
No, we didn't hear that specifically. We heard that on a tape. We actually, it was myself, I was looking for a place to rent because we were moving from Ypsilanti to Ann Arbor. And I went into the very first place that I went to. There was a young man there who took me around the place. It was a three-bedroom apartment, three-bedroom house, very, very nice. And he took me around the place and let me see it, and, you know, I was really thrilled about it and what have you. And then when we finished the tour, he looks at me and he says, "Loretta, if you want this place, you can have it." And I'm like, is this guy crazy? What is he thinking? You know, I'm okay, that's kind of good, but, you know, it doesn't feel right. What are you talking about? And he said, "I just want to let you know that our landlord told us that she did not want to rent to black people." And then my mouth dropped. Mm. And he went on to say that we don't feel like that, because this is a white guy telling me, a black woman, that his landlord didn't want to rent to blacks. And so I'm like, what is a gimmick? You know, this sort of thing. Until finally he says, "You know, I feel terrible about this because I actually have neighbors who are black. Our kids go play with them, you know, so for her to think that I think like her is appalling." And so he gave me the number for Fair Housing Center, and he told me, "Give them a call and let them know if you want, you know, let them know what happened. And truly, if you want this house, you can get it. Fair Housing will get it for you," this sort of thing. So I left the tour, and as I was driving, I had to pull over to the side of the road, and I just bawled, because my thought was, again, how could this happen to me? I'm educated. I did all the right things. Why would this person, I haven't even met her, why would she think like that towards me, towards my race? What did I do or somebody do personally? Mm. And then I went, you know, then I eventually drove home and told my husband about it. And we let it go. We let the matter go, because my thought was, same like my husband, why would we want to rent from a woman who feels like that?
Pam, walk us through what you did in Loretta's situation, please.
Loretta contacted us. We had also been in contact with he was the current tenant that had shown them around. And we took a complaint from her, and we advised her. We said, if you want the house, go back and meet with the landlord and offer her a deposit. So they met with her directly. They offered her the deposit. She said, "I'm really sorry. I'm not going to rent to a family of five." The Codringtons, Loretta and her husband had three children at the time. So we did what we call testing. We had a white tester posing as married with three children, a white woman, contact the landlord, meet with her, offer a deposit for the house, and the landlord accepted her as a tenant. Of course, she didn't move in, but... we were able to show that her, of course she wasn't going to say to their face, she knows it's illegal to say, "I'm not renting to a black family." So she made up another reason, "I'm not renting to a family of five," until we brought a white woman posing as a woman with a family, with five people in her family.
Is that still how you pursue cases where you feel race is a factor in discrimination? With the tester, I mean?
Testing is really the only way to uncover illegal housing discrimination when it comes to race, national origin.
And what was the final outcome, Pam?
After we had the evidence of discrimination based on race, we met with the Codringtons, and they decided that they wanted to file a lawsuit in federal court. So we found them attorneys in private practice. They filed a lawsuit, and the case settled for $15,000.
We're talking about Fair Housing in Michigan with Pam Kish, the executive director of the Fair Housing Center of Southeastern Michigan, which covers Ingham County, along with Loretta Codrington, an Ann Arbor resident who's experienced housing discrimination firsthand. How common is any form of illegal housing discrimination in Michigan, Pam?
I can only go by national statistics. Every 10 years, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development does a study, and I think it's still around 40 to 50% of the time an African-American family or a Latino family goes to look for housing, either in the rental or the sales market. They're more likely to be discriminated against, obviously, when compared to a white family.
Loretta, looking back on this from 20 years into the future, how do you feel about the way this was resolved?
Well, I feel very good. The Fair Housing Center came alongside us. They educated us on what it was we needed to do. Because, like I mentioned, my husband and I had given the situation away, and we were thinking we did not in any way want to go and have to deal with this, you know, this woman or this situation.
What changed your mind, Loretta?
Well, because Fair Housing Center was very, very cooperative and helpful and explained to us. The thing that changed changed her mind is, and this is how naive I was about it. She said, you know, you guys don't have to live there. And so I was like, oh, okay, great. Then we can go ahead and, you know, pursue this, but I don't want to have to live under this lady's roof. And Pam told us, no, you don't have to live there, but this is what we're going to do. And so they told us about testing. We went back, like Pam said, we went back, and I actually met this woman. I saw her face-to-face. My husband and I were there, and we met her. And we took money. We had cash money that we took to say, you know, hey, we're ready to rent this house right now. We knew, and the young man that was renting the house previously knew that it was a setup. That was our goal. Our goal was to get her to admit to us or get her to, you know, to refuse us, and she did. She refused us, even the money that we had. You know, we were like, oh, wow, this is exciting. We're really to rent it right now. Mm-hmm. We have the deposit. And she said, no, I have some other people that we're looking at. And she called us later and told us that we had too many kids, that the kids would be hard on the appliances. And there was nothing else that we can do but say okay and let it go.
Pam, you've been at this for more than 20 years. In general, how big a problem is illegal housing discrimination here in Michigan?
I think it's a huge problem in Michigan and everywhere. There's nothing unique about Michigan. I think the complaints that we get in our office, about 150, 160 a year, is the tip of the iceberg. Mm. Again, most discrimination is, I'm so sorry, I just rented the last apartment. Most people walk away and have no idea they'd been the victim of discrimination. And I wanted to follow up on what Loretta was saying. Nobody wants to live in a place where they've been the victim of discrimination. And I'm sure one of the things we said to the Codringtons was, if you pursue this, not only does it help you because you're being compensated for your loss of civil rights, but it sends a message to the community, to the rest of people who might be renting a place out and think, gee, you know, I better educate myself about fair housing. I better be careful who I hire. I better follow the rules, because if I don't, it's gonna become public. A lot of people have, you know, sort of their private feelings about race and national origin, and as long as they can get away with it, they will. But once it's in the front page of the newspaper, they may be more apt to do the right thing.
How many cases has your organization handled over the years?
We've handled thousands, over 3,000 complaints, and we've helped people file over 70 lawsuits.
What is the source of most discrimination in 2013? Is it race?
The most common complaint we get now is discrimination based on physical disability.
How many in Ingham County?
I'd say we get about 15% of the complaints we get. So maybe 20 to 25 a year. We've only been covering Ingham County for a few years, and we don't have an office here.
Looking back on this whole thing, Loretta, how has going through this, how has this affected you?
Well, you know, I have a huge respect for the Fair Housing Center and the work that Pam and the others do. We totally were blown away by how they were able to help us to understand this process. When I first started, my thought was, my concern, I guess, was that, okay, they're educating us, but the bad folks are being educated too. Okay, and so what is that going to do to the people who are being educated? Because the woman who discriminated against us, you know, she got a slap on the wrist, $15,000. You know, I don't know, maybe that was a whole lot of money for her or what have you, but she ended up renting to a white couple anyway, you know, so it didn't deter anything for her. It just, to me, in my estimation, it just made her smarter about doing that. But like Pam said, there are still lots and lots of cases where people think that they can do this and get away with it and not understand that, you know, this affects, you know, the whole community.
So, Pam, you're saying that the smile, the handshake, the sympathetic tone of voice works an awful lot of the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Who does your legal work?
We have a list of attorneys in private practice, and we're handing them a winning case. It's all been investigated, and we just say to them, you take it from here.
Why are fair housing organizations important? I mean, can't the same work be done by HUD or local government, let's say?
Private fair housing centers like ours are the only organizations that do fair housing testing. HUD can do investigations, but they do not do testing, and very few cities, municipalities have a testing program. It's really up to the private fair housing centers in this country to do the testing. And there, again, really is no other way to uncover race discrimination, discrimination based on national origin, some familial status discrimination, unless you do paired testing.
And how does the law work with regard to housing discrimination against the LGBT population?
Some cities have local ordinances that say that you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. We also use sex discrimination and marital status discrimination under state and federal law, and that will sometimes help us with someone who's being discriminated against because they're two men looking for a place to live together.
And your organization's received $275,000. What will you do with that money?
We've made a commitment to take about 150-60 complaints. We're going to do a lot of paired testing. Some of the testing is going to be in relation to complaints. Some of it is going to be what we call survey testing. We're going to do a lot of advocacy on behalf of people with disabilities. Person uses a wheelchair. They need their own parking space right in front of the apartment complex door because they can't park just anywhere and slush through the snow. And we'll write a letter to the owner saying this person needs their own reserved parking space. This person needs a ramp. This person needs rules can be bent. Someone gets Social Security. They can't work because they have a disability. They get their Social Security on the third day of the month, and they're charged a late fee.
Is accessibility the landlord's responsibility?
If the property has federal funding, then it's the landlord's responsibility to put in a ramp or make things accessible. For the most part, no. It's the tenant's responsibility to pay for a reasonable modification.
Loretta, I'm curious. Have you had occasion to meet many other people who have been discriminated against?
After our case was resolved, I served on the Board of Fair Housing Center, so yes, I did meet quite a few people who were also discriminated against in various capacities. And the story is the same. I mean, in terms of the shock that people are still being treated like this in the U.S. and, you know, and the fact that the Fair Housing Center is here to help people who don't know and educate people who don't know.
Well, Loretta Codrington is an Ann Arbor resident who's experienced housing discrimination firsthand. We've also been joined by Pam Kish, Executive Director of the Fair Housing Center of Southeastern Michigan, which covers Ingham County. Pam, Loretta, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. High schools and colleges around the country are facing an alarming trend. A number of studies from places such as the University of Florida and the Hearing Health Foundation report as many as one teenager in four has some degree of hearing loss. And Current State's Kevin Lavery is here to tell us more. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark. That's right. This epidemic of what you might loosely call early onset hearing loss represents a marked increase today over past generations. It's very difficult, actually, to pinpoint the cause of this problem. Experts say it's not as simple as simply blaming it on these ubiquitous earbuds that the digital generation has. Many say we simply live in a louder world with more audio stimulation. Michigan State University is tackling this issue through a program that helps the hearing impaired navigate their work and personal lives.
Jeffrey Astrin has spent a lifetime beating the odds. Last August, the 4'5" Michigan State University grad student was part of the U.S. volleyball team that took the silver medal at the World Dwarf Games in East Lansing. But that victory pales in comparison to another battle Astrin fought much earlier in life. At age 2, Jeffrey Astrin had a brush with cancer. During his treatment, he lost his hearing.
Ever since that time, I've been hearing impaired from a very young age. It's been quite an experience. Also a lot of challenges, but nonetheless, I pull through and do what I can do in the whole day.
Several years ago, Astrin formed a strong friendship with one of his mentors, Don Power. He's a retired labor negotiator, an adjunct MSU professor, and former East Lansing City Councilman. In his younger days, Power flew in helicopters in Vietnam, something he believes may have hastened his own gradual hearing loss. That may be one reason why he and Astrin bonded so quickly.
Jeffrey and I got involved with what and huh. And those are probably the two most important words that welded us together.
Astrin and Power are graduates of MSU's inaugural Cooser program. It's named for Kathy Cooser, a licensed independent social worker from Dayton, Ohio, who herself struggles with hearing loss. The Cooser program teaches participants, both the hearing impaired and their communication partners, techniques for coping with the emotional and social aspects of hearing loss. Michigan State University is running three separate workshops this spring. The first, held in January, was geared almost exclusively towards students. Virginia Martz is a deaf and hard of hearing mobility and disability specialist with the Resource Center for Persons with Disabilities at MSU. She's seen her share of incoming students with some level of hearing loss over the years, but Martz says she's been alarmed by some recent statistics.
What really startled me was when it came out in fall of 2012 was the first time they were saying publicly, disability offices, be prepared, we're looking at 1 in 4 students having some hearing loss.
Mart says in most cases, students come to see her as they slowly begin to realize the gaps in their education. They're missing key parts of lectures or not understanding verbal instructions. Some are already beyond that point.
Others coming in saying, I have hearing loss, but they did not know what they needed, or they were not familiar with their hearing aids. And so I have immediate concern about what's going to happen to them as they move through college and then into employment.
Jeffrey Astrin already knows the frustration that hearing impaired people feel in their daily work interactions. He's often found himself asking for information several times, which he concedes is frustrating for the employer. Astrin does not want to be in the position of failing the task because he failed to understand the requirements.
I can take notes and then go back and start my work, but it might not be the product you're looking for, and I don't want to submit a product that's either unprofessional or way off of what they asked for. That's not a good image of me, it's not good for the employer, and it makes an unhealthy workplace.
Don Power, the former labor negotiator, is looking out for Astrin's interests. He says only about a third of employers who hire people with hearing disabilities actually make accommodations for them. In addition, Power says, the hearing impaired face economic disparity.
When Jeffrey starts work, on average, anybody with a hearing loss will probably have an income decrease of about $23,000 a year starting. And if you're a woman, it's an additional 15%. For me, that's a crime.
Economics aside, Cooser program facilitators say they're trying to head off workplace tensions that could escalate into disciplinary action toward the employee. Jenny Pyatt manages the Business Network Unit of Michigan Rehabilitation Services, a division of the Michigan Department of Human Services.
It's very subtle. It may be an employee who, you know, was doing their job, they felt like everything was fine, all of a sudden their supervisor comes up to them out of the blue and said, look, I got 3 customer complaints this week, saying you turned their back and you didn't respond to what they were asking for. And that oftentimes, that's when MRS gets involved, because again, it's that 11th hour of something's got to change or I'm going to end up losing my job.
Two key objectives seem to stand out within the Cooser program: self-advocacy and patience. That last virtue is a lesson Don Power learned the hard way one night. He and Jeffrey were watching an MSU basketball game on TV, but the sound was turned down. Jeffrey missed the play.
And he asked me, what happened? And I thought, what do you mean, what happened? You just saw what happened. I forgot. He may have visually saw it, but he didn't hear the description. And then I thought, this is a part of your being patient, he being patient with we be patient with each other as we work together.
For his part, Jeffrey Astrin still sticks to his tried and true coping strategies. He admits large group meetings are hard to follow. So are phone conversations, especially on cell phones. And without watching a speaker's lips, even the simple act of enjoying a dinner conversation is strained whenever Astrin looks down at his plate. Still, he feels his newly learned techniques will be useful, provided the people around him are also willing to meet him halfway.
I've got to be very careful as we go down the line and then end up somewhere where I know I'm going to be successful, where I know I can give a lot of contribution and be able to live my life comfortably.
The CUSER program sessions at Michigan State University continue through February. MSU will host one more four-week workshop later this spring. Organizers say they hope to create a long-term program in the near future. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we've heard a lot about how cities are impacted by hosting the Olympic Games. How might the city of Detroit have been altered if one of its bids had been successful? Also, we'll have live music from Michael Ling tomorrow on Current State. And speaking of music, I also want to acknowledge the newest addition to the Current State staff, if you will, a 1936 Steinway piano, recently restored and refurbished. It's beautiful. It's sitting about 10 feet away from me right now, a Model S, smaller than a baby grand. It's not a baby grand, but you will be hearing it soon and regularly, not only here on Current State's Live Music Fridays, but in WKAR classical music segments as well. It's going to sound great on Current State. So you'll be hearing more of that to come, we promise. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is our show's producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Cole, and Kevin Labry. Also, thank you Aaron Young for engineering and Kelsey Block for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.